From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There was something about the middle of the 19th century in this country that inspired thousands of people to long for a more perfect society. In his new book, the writer Chris Jennings says at least 100 experimental communities were created during this time. These were utopian communalist movements, and some were more popular than others, some were stranger than others, but all were dedicated to creating a new social order. Jennings has chosen five of these groups to explore, and today in the program he'll join us to talk about them. One of the things that's really interesting is that all of these groups question conventional ideas, like the importance of the family or the need for monogamy and private property and religion and competition. The basic question they all worked through was this: what sort of future do we want? Join us after the news.
Hey, you. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you hear the particulars of some of the utopian communities Chris Jennings writes about in his new book, it's going to be tempting to make fun. I mean, let's be honest, some of the ideas were kind of strange. They're ideas about free sex or no sex, or the belief that one day friendly whales would tow ships in the sea, or this idea that the ocean could taste like lemonade. But Jennings doesn't mock these people in his book. In fact, he was pleasantly surprised to find that they were not fools. They were smart and hardworking and articulate. And not only that, they were innovative and creative and social. They didn't try and impose their ideas. They tried to live by example. The question that drove him was this: how did these reasonable people come to adopt some kind of unreasonable ideas? And the reason is really interesting. Today in the program, Chris Jennings is joining us. His book is Paradise Now: The Story of American Utopianism. Chris is joining us today from the studios of NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. And Chris Jennings, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So you say, I wanted to begin with that idea of you not really thinking of these people as fools, that they were reasonable, that they were hardworking, and you really seem to like them. I mean, you get a sense of that, I think, throughout the book. Did that surprise you when you first started that you were going to like them so much, if that's even accurate to put it that way?
No, it is accurate, and it did surprise me. I mean, the sort of usual historical treatment of these folks when it happens at all usually is kind of mocking them, or at the very least describing them as sort of excessive in their optimism about what America might become in its earlier days. So I was surprised to encounter so much intelligence and hard work and sort of lived virtue. These were people with really strong values. And I think we have a tendency, maybe because in the 20th century, sort of communal experimentation is something we've associated with sort of middle-class youths. Yeah. It was surprising to find that these people were, you know, from every walk of life and, you know, clergymen, bankers, farmers. These weren't sort of young people running around having a crazy time.
When did you first get interested in it? What was the thing that got you started on the project?
You know, I think I kind of stumbled into it because I had always had a standing interest in 20th century sort of hippie communes and, you know, the Back to the Land movement. And in researching that, I kept hearing reference to these communities that had existed before the Civil War. And as I started to sort of read a little bit around them, I was just amazed by how much more wild the ideas were in the middle of the 19th century than even in, say, the 1960s and 70s. We associate this era of American history, you know, it's the sort of Jacksonian era with the genesis of various American ideas, you know, the rugged individual, westward expansion, the birth of sort of free market capitalism in the country. And it was just a shock to find a completely parallel and counter history to that whole narrative. People who were celebrating socialism and free love and women's rights and things like that.
When you hear utopian today, What do you think most people are thinking about? Because you say it's really kind of thought of as a slur these days.
Yeah, I think that certainly when you hear it in a political context, yeah. And I'm sure it will we'll hear it from time to time in the ensuing political drama that's playing out now. It's a way of describing some position as frivolous, and that's not inaccurate. I mean, putting forth proposals that can never be put into action is in some ways less serious. but I think that there's something to be said for sort of thinking grandly about the future with a relatively loose grip on the limitations of the world as it is. As the 19th century utopians show us, they arrived at certain places that the rest of society took another 100 years to get to, certain ethical positions about, you know, public education maybe should be free and maybe women and men are actually equal. These ideas which were lumped in with all of their other wild utopian ideas in the 1840s, say, now we realize that they were – their sort of loose grip on the present allowed them to see where we all needed to go in certain ways.
I actually want to come back to this right toward the end, this question of what happens then in a modern context when you don't have fantasies about the future. We'll come back to that. You quote this historian, Tony Jute, who said that today's intellectuals shouldn't be wasting their time on trying to imagine a better world, but trying to prevent a worse one, which just, I guess, gives us a sense of what we think about the utopian idea today, that it's, as you say, and like in literature, it's thought of as soul-crushing. It's thought of as a farce. We just don't think much of it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we have plenty of good reason for that. I mean, the 20th century was a bloodbath,
yeah.
Largely at the hand of several sort of faintly millenarian or utopian ideologies about, you know, this idea that the entire society can be sort of forcefully changed. And so we are absolutely right to flinch from such ideas. At the same time, not having any sort of narrative about the future is, I think, very dangerous. I mean, you know, Americans in particular, although I think this is true of many nations, has a very specific story about our founding and who we are and how we became who we are. And if you don't have a comparable story about sort of where you're going, I think you're more likely to sort of just scramble around in the status quo without really much progress.
Mm. What is the utopian view of the world? Because you said before it's not this list of problems. It's not a litany of the problems that you're fixing. It's describing a world, you say, where those things just don't happen. So it's kind of more of a positive spin on what's wrong with the world, I guess.
Exactly. Although, of course, implicit in that positive vision of the world is a critique of the present, right?
Yeah.
You don't describe a world in which there's no poverty if you don't think that poverty is somehow objectionable.
Sure.
Fantasizing about an ideal society is one very effective way and historically has been a very effective way of organizing one's complaints with the here and now. Although unlike other modes of sort of critiquing the present, it comes with a certain amount of enthusiasm and energy that I think is sometimes helpful in creating progress, right? If you're just sitting around saying this is wrong with the world, this is wrong with the world, and this is wrong with the world, you're not as inclined to sort of mobilize a large group of people towards change than as if you're describing a society that is actually like stirring people's hearts and getting them excited to advance towards that.
Well, and that's what the utopians were doing. I mean, they were like, okay, this is the problem. Now let's do away with this, and we will create a workday that is this, and there won't be segregated men and women. And I mean, they put the idea into practice. I guess that's what's appealing in some way for you.
Absolutely, yeah. I think what's exciting about these people, and obviously, I should say that all of these communities have since dissolved, and their plans were, you know, proved to be fairly unworkable. Though I don't think that means that they sort of were failures, since people had lived lovely chapters of their lives in some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what's exciting, and I think something that's very particular to this era in American history, was the fact that people concocted these wild ideas, most of them which actually derived in Europe, and then Americans or recent emigres from Europe had this notion that, sure, we could just go do it. And they bought a piece of land and tried to do it, tried to completely reorganize society in very fundamental ways, not just like let's all live on a farm and share our food, but let's give up marriage or let's all be married to each other or, you know, let's have the work day. Let's have everyone work seven different jobs and cycle through them. You know, they were just completely trying to change the sort of basics, the building blocks of society.
So you begin with this story. This gets us to the 19th century, although this is at the end of the 18th. This is 1780. I just thought it was a cool story. I'm not sure how it plays into sort of how it ushers in this era necessarily, but it's this I'd never heard about this. It's this day in May in 1780 when this crazy darkness descends on New England. Caused by, I'm not really sure what, I guess it was fog or smoke or cloud cover or whatever it might be, but it came to be known as the Dark Day. Tell us a little bit about this day and how it kind of figures into the way you're thinking about this story.
Sure. I mean, it was just a freak of nature. I mean, there's still debate about what the actual causes are. They think that enormous wildfires in Canada and Algonquin National Park combined with some sort of weather system to create this just absolute blackout of, I think it was mostly eastern New England and a little bit of, western New England, a little bit of eastern New York. And so for the people who were living, and this is, you know, sort of in the middle of the revolution, things are not going well for the patriots, the rebels, and there's a sort of paranoia of war already in the area. People are a little bit hungry and very high strung because they're on alert for sabotage, especially in the region around the Hudson River, which was a vital military position connecting the city of New York and the port in New York up to the forts in the Adirondacks. And so this is an area where there's sort of Tory sabotage and neighbors are all looking at their neighbors to see whose side are you on. And in the midst of this, there's also this very intense millenarian religious upheaval, people who are preaching the coming of the New Jerusalem, the kingdom of God is at hand. And so in that context, the fact that the day suddenly the sun basically disappears around noon and doesn't the whatever darkness, whatever caused the darkness, the weather system doesn't lift until in the middle of the night. So basically it lasts through to the next morning, although people see the moon, happens to echo some language in the Book of Revelation about the prelude to the end of the world. And, you know, it says the sun will go dark as sackcloth and the moon will be as blood. So the fact that the sun indeed disappears and then in that night the moon apparently shone with a reddish tint when it finally did come out, for people who are already primed in this apocalyptic sort of thinking, they thought it was an indisputable sign that the end times were about to unfold. So I think it plays into the story because it captures the how present this sort of maybe supernatural is the wrong word, but ideas about, you know, the end of the world, how present they were in people's lives and what an intense environment this was. And this specific event caused the Shakers, who then were a very small reclusive community of about six or seven people, to open up their gospel, as they say, to begin preaching to Americans. They themselves were British.
Right. There are these two ideas that begin to converge, and I mean it's remarkable when you think about it why it is during this particular period in the 19th century that the United States goes through this, you know, as you put it in the book, utopian longing and experimentation. And a couple of factors are going on that you mentioned in the book. One of them is really old. One of them is modern. The old one is this idea that it's a Judeo-Christian concept that history, you say, begins and ends with paradise. We start with a Garden of Eden, and we're supposed to end similarly with this kind of idea of paradise. And then the second idea is that is more rational. It comes from the Enlightenment, that humankind progresses, that we're supposed to be headed somewhere to perfectibility. And I just wanted you to talk about those two ideas because it seems like there's an old faith, there's a new faith, and they come together. That's the thing that's fueling all of this in the 19th century.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it is remarkable because one of the ideas is so deeply mystical.
Yeah.
This idea that history will be bookended by the the Garden of Eden on one end and the sort of New Jerusalem, which is, you know, the descending from the sky, God will lower down to us this holy, perfected city.
Right.
In which, you know, at the end of history. So that's this very mystical and very ancient idea that occurs, actually, I think, in other faith traditions also, but it's obviously a cornerstone of the Judeo-Christian narrative. And the other idea, which you describe as modern, and at the time it certainly was very modern and incredibly widespread. Now I think it has less resonance. People no longer believe that human society is sort of ineluctably improving every decade.
Right.
We've had enough major setbacks in that process to question that idea. But that idea was, and people had a lot of good reason for thinking that at the time. It wasn't a foolish thing to think. I think we now tend to think that we're living in a time with a lot of change and things are really changing quickly with technology in our society. But I think if you were dropped into the the end of the American Revolution, say, or even as late as the middle of the 19th century, the rate of change was so bewildering that reasonable people could conclude that society would sort of soon be perfect. We suddenly had steam engines, and though the new technology was wreaking all kinds of havoc in various places, it also implied that, well, in a few years, if a machine can now do what formerly it took 100 men to do, in a few years we'll have all of our material needs totally supplied. We're simultaneously getting more enlightened, where democracy is taking root. We're sort of realizing that these ancient evils of slavery are need to be eradicated from the earth. Of course, none of this played out as quickly and as easily as people thought it might. But that also, that sort of enlightenment thinking for Europeans, I think, was really amplified by just sort of the presence of the North American continent, which, even though it was fairly populated, they sort of regarded as this Edenic void in which this new future that seemed to be on the brink of happening could all sort of start here and get a foothold here in the United States or in North America.
It's the new world.
It's the new world, and they were still calling it the new world. You know, we don't use that language too much, but people writing in the end of the American Revolution, especially the sort of social theorists and stuff, still very much are referring to North America as the new world.
So there's a lot of this utopian experimenting going on, and we'll get into the particulars here in a moment. At least 100 of these communities crop up, some more successful than others, some kind of stranger than others. But you picked 5 to focus on, and obviously we'll break them down as we go. But why these 5 that you profile?
I think I picked them. I mean, I think I picked this era because I think it shows it's sort of the high watermark or like golden age of American utopianism, which is something that existed prior to these communities I describe and certainly has existed since and probably still exists in some form, though I don't see much. But so this is sort of the peak of this sort of movement that has run through American history. And then I felt that these 5 captured basically the whole story. I mean, they were among the more prominent of the communities, but they capture both the secular and the religious aspect of the American utopianism. And what's exciting is that though their ideas were very different, they were all in dialogue with each other. They identified each other as sort of more or less engaged in the same project. Certainly Americans who were not involved with any of these communities tended to look upon them as all being part of one general movement. They were seen as somehow connected to one another from the outside as well as from the inside. So the 5, the story begins with the Shakers, who are an avowedly religious order, but then they go on. Some very secular reformers are inspired by the Shakers, and then those secular reformers have their ideas subsequently picked up again by very religious people, and it's sort of the idea ping-pongs back and forth between religious and secular groups, and they're all basically engaged in the same project, I would say.
I guess I have to ask, since I'm here in Salt Lake City, but you didn't choose the Mormons as one of the 5. Joseph Smith and Mormonism does figure into this story, which we'll get to, but that wasn't one of the ones you really focused on. What did you think about the Mormon experiment in those days?
I mean, I think it's very much coming out of the same, I mean, literally the same time and place where Smith has his first revelations is he's surrounded by, yeah, by these utopian groups. And so, and he's influenced by, he seems to be influenced by similar passages in the New Testament that the utopians are fixated on. And then as I guess we'll discuss later, there was a very literal relationship with them having sold a community,
right,
to some French communists. The Latter-day Saints community in Illinois. But I don't think
in
Nauvoo, exactly. Yeah. And I don't think that the early Mormonism, it was as fundamentally utopian as these other groups were. And certainly I don't think, you know, it has grown into something that more strongly resembles other large religious movements. The emphasis is not entirely on communalism, mm-hmm, and sort of building a new world within the old, though certainly there are a lot of echoes there. And I'm sure a case could be made that they belong in these ranks. But it's a very different story because it's still active and thriving religion.
Yeah. Chris Jennings is with us. His book is Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're looking back at this fascinating time in American history in the 19th century when dozens of these utopian communities cropped up. The writer Chris Jennings has picked five of these groups in particular. He profiles them in his book called Paradise Now. Their ideas about common property and free sex or no family. Some were religious, some weren't. And he's joining us today, Chris Jennings, from NPR station KQED in San Francisco to talk about it. What were the common elements, Chris Jennings, to all of this, to a utopian society? I mean, as I mentioned, some, like the Shakers, believed in celibacy, no sex. Others believed in rampant free sex. So they were, you know, some believed in that God was essential or religion was essential. Some sort of ditched that idea. Some believed in family. Some didn't. But did they have, what were the common components?
I would say that the most basic commonalities amongst all these communities across both the religious and the more or less secular communities was they all were very interested in the abolition of property, private property. So they were all sort of communistic, though this is pre-Marxian communism.
Yeah.
And they all basically believed in the abolition of the family as the basic unit of society. They might have phrased it not as the abolition of the family, but as the expansion of the family, but
right,
they didn't. They all sort of felt that the what they called the isolated family unit was an obsolete institution that sort of was holding the world back because it kept us from being fully committed to improving society. Where the family is sort of a hotbed of, as they tell it, of sort of selfishness, mm-hmm, and what they used the word individualism. It had a different meaning then than it does now. It was more pejorative. So those are, I think, are the most fundamental connections. And then the overarching belief that they were on the brink of creating a perfect society,
yeah,
that the world was able to be transformed. That was sort of their starting assumption, I suppose.
Gender equality was they all had that in common, didn't they?
They did, to greater and lesser extent.
Right.
And of course, it's important to separate sort of their rhetoric and their texts,
the practice,
which survive,
yeah,
from practice, since, yeah, of course, they were people of their time. But yeah, I mean, the Shakers, you know, for most of their history were led by women and tried to have a fairly exacting equality between men and women. Again, it didn't always work out. It was maybe easier for them since their prophet and founder was a woman, Anne Lee. But pretty much all the other groups, if at the very least, paid a lot of lip service to gender equality. I'm sure some of the women living in these communities might have told a different story.
Right. One of the things you mentioned in the book is that the base unit, as you put it, of utopian thinking wasn't necessarily the community or the individual. It was the day. It was the typical day. Would you explain that? I thought that was really interesting.
I think that that's true not just of these communities and not just of actual experimental communities, but of utopian literature, the whole concept of utopian. I mean, people who read sort of utopian sci-fi literature will certainly recognize the notion that there's always this description of, you know, I woke up on the planet and I took this kind of fancy tram to my office where everything was neatly organized. And I mean, if you even in dystopian literature, this comes out, politics, or sort of a political idea being advanced by describing an individual's day. And I think the reason for that is one of the ways utopianism differs from other methods of sort of changing the world is that it really depends on people being able to picture in their mind what a society looks like in a very detailed, gritty way. You don't expect, for example, the Declaration of Independence to come also with a schematic for how the Capitol building is going to look. You know, it's advancing a set of political ideas about, you know, freedom and equality, for instance. And but it's not sort of drawing in actual colors, whereas a utopian text would say, you know, and we're going to wear blue shirts and on Wednesdays we're going to have tacos. You're enticing people with a vision that's very specific. They have to be able to sort of hold it up to the what I think is sort of the basic utopian criterion, which is, can I imagine myself living in this society? Does it sound nice to me? Does it sound plausible to me? That's sort of how the utopian pushes his idea across, as opposed to in broader terms.
We mentioned a little bit about the Shakers. I wanted to ask about sort of another one of these sort of movements that emerges. Robert Owen, this is 1824 when he comes to the United States, New Harmony, Indiana, to create this idea, as he conceives it, as this new moral world. Tell us about Robert Owen.
Yeah, Owen is sort of the best example of someone who's claiming to be secular, and when I say secular, I don't mean that there weren't any people of faith in these communities, just that the community wasn't principally organized around a religious idea. Right. But so Owen calls himself secular and eventually calls himself an atheist, which gets him in a lot of trouble. But he clearly has imbibed the millenarian rhetoric and attitudes of his time, you know, the sort of throughout European and American Protestantism, this was sort of a high point for belief that the millennium, the sort of paradise on earth, was coming. And so Owen believes that the mechanism by which this perfected society will be created isn't going to be God coming down from the sky or God influencing humans. It will be sort of these Enlightenment values and engineers and planners, and once we abolish religion and private property, and eventually he throws marriage on the heap too, we'll be able to create these small communities of perfect equality. And all we need to do is get one of them up and running, which is what he was trying to do in Indiana. And it will be so beautiful and its example will be so compelling that people will immediately start recreating them. And within a few short years, the whole globe will be blanketed in these societies of perfect equality. I mean, at the outset, Owen is literally concerned the change will happen too fast and
right.
It will be disorganized.
Right.
And before he did any of this, he was already an incredibly wealthy and famous man. He ran basically the largest and most successful textile manufacturing firm in New Lanark in Scotland. And he took the fortune he'd made there, and his mill town basically had become a sort of tourist attraction. It was the face of a new, more humane industrialism, where he didn't have orphans working at the mills for 12 hours a day. He had a school program for them, and everyone lived in hygienic tenements with little gardens. And he was sort of celebrated as this new kind of industrialist. And this is at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, where a lot of people are looking with concern at what industrialism will, what effect it will have on the world. So Owen becomes very famous and rich, and then comes to the United States to try and put this plan into action. And it doesn't go very well, but it's very interesting in the meantime.
It really is. What's the parallelogram that he has in mind?
The parallelogram is another thing. You asked what these people all had in common. They all, for various reasons, had their own sort of house of the future that everyone was going to live in. And something that was common to all of them, and which is totally lacking from 20th century utopianism, is they all believed that in the future we'll all live inside one big building. Not everyone on the earth, but in every sort of city will be one building. And again, that very closely echoes the biblical account of the city of New Jerusalem is kind of described as one intact building. And so the parallelogram was Owen's answer, and it was going to be this massive structure. And the numbers changed over time, but, you know, maybe as many as 20,000 people would be living in this large, basically a town inside of one structure, an open quadrangle. It was going to allow working people, farmers and mechanics, as they were called in that day, basically industrial workers and machinists and stuff, to live in to have access to the luxuries that at that time were only enjoyed by the very wealthy, like gas lighting and sort of industrial laundry facilities. And it was a sort of industrial solution to the problems of the time. It was we're going to apply the industrial logic to all of life's woes. And it made sense that Owen wanted to do that because he was a very successful manufacturer.
Let's talk about Charles. Is it Fourier?
Fourier.
He's this French social theorist, and he gets this following in the United States. He conceives of utopia, but not as he has this idea of these kind of smaller villages. And I'm really interested in they're kind of these complexes called what are they called? How do you pronounce it?
Well, phalanxes would be the name of the village. And then his answer to Owen's parallelogram, his what they called – they all called them unitary dwellings. The Shakers had them. The Owenites had them. The Fourierists had them. His was called a phalanstery.
Very
grand Versailles-like structure in which people in the future will all live.
Groups of 1,620, as a matter of fact. It seems like that was a very particular number.
One of Fourier's many charming manias is his obsession with numeric specificity. So he says each of these communities must have 1,620 because that number represents twice the 810 human types, what he calls passional types, that he's diagnosed within the human race. So you need two of every kind of person in your community for all of life's work to be accomplished. By someone who truly is passionate about it. You need someone who just can't help but baking bread all day and someone who just wants to fix tires all day.
Yeah.
And so you get two of every kind in a community, and that adds up to 1,620. None of the American Fourierist communities, and there were, or phalanxes as they called themselves, there were about almost 30 of them. None of them ever reached that large number, though some of them got fairly large.
It's interesting. He seemed... He had this idea, you say in the book, that ultimately we'd get to this point where every human impulse would be satisfied and here's the sort of the term that I keyed on, satisfied and rendered productive. So it seems like Fourier had this idea that things would be useful, that everything needed to be useful. So there's this idea, and I wanted you to talk about, like, that mosquitoes would – because I guess they didn't seem useful, would eventually go extinct. And this is this idea that these friendly whales would tow ships. And you've got to talk about boreal fluid. this is really fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the crux of all of that usefulness, as you well described it, is his belief that there are – though he was maligned in the United States as a you know, godless French – sex freak. He, in fact, was a sort of Enlightenment-style deist, and he believed that God wanted us to be happy and that the world was supposed to be perfect. And the reason it wasn't now, the reason there was, you know, everything from malaria to hunger to backaches to, you know, long lines at the bank, is because the world is sort of misaligned. We're out of the word he always uses is harmony. He thinks when everything is functioning properly, the globe and all of its inhabitants, and in fact the cosmos, ideas had no limit, would all sort of attain a certain harmony in which everything would work perfectly. And he thinks that all the impulses that we have in us that society, especially the Victorian society in which his followers were living, all of these impulses that we are actively repressing, whether it's various sexual proclivities or violence or bloodlust, all the things that we as a society are always struggling to control, are in fact God-given. Like he calls them the springs of action. Right. They've been put into us by our Creator so that we can act on them, and in acting on them, produce wonderful effects. So an example that everyone always enjoys is that he thought that in the future, little groups of little boys, he calls them little hordes, will go out every morning and they'll have dogs and trumpets and wagons and go collect trash. Because he says little boys are naturally inclined to like filth. And they just love getting messy and they love making a big noise. So in the future, that impulse will be harnessed for a social good, namely having the little boys become trash collectors. And in terms of the Boreal fluid, his idea, and it's funny, all the things we laugh at about Fourier, he did very accurately say at a time when it sounded totally absurd that human industry would change the temperature of the globe and warm it. The difference is he thought it would be a good thing, and the world will just all feel like southern Italy eventually. But this warming will cause the ice caps to melt, and I don't quite know how he arrived at this notion, but the ice caps in melting will release something that he calls boreal fluid into the seas, eventually rendering them tasty, making them taste sort of like lemon soda. So, you know, the lemonade sea is eternally trotted out as the sort of height of utopian absurdity. And I suppose it is the height of utopian absurdity. But it was part of his sort of global vision for how the world will become perfected as humans reorganize their social structures.
Yeah. Chris Jennings is with us. His book is Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism. We need to take another break. But we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Chris Jennings. We're talking about his new book, Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism. We should at least mention how we get the name Utopia. This comes from Thomas More, who writes this book in 1516. It's the name he gives this fictional nation. And you write a bit about it in the book. And More imagines no economic classes. I thought that was really interesting, that especially given the context of where he was, that he conceives of no private property and he conceives of no idle gentry, no economic classes, because all of that stuff existed where he was trying to sort of make a living. And then also lots of food and music and sensual pleasures like sex, which didn't seem to square at all with the sort of religious fundamentalist that he kind of became. Talk a little bit about Thomas More, because I liked this. This is where we'll eventually get to Etienne Cabet, is that how he pronounces his name, by the way?
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right.
He reads Utopia, and that influences him. But you want to say something about Thomas More? Because I liked his idea, too.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, his ideas definitely had a direct effect on these people. Robert Owen and Cabet both read More's Utopia with great interest. I would say all of them, except for maybe the Shakers, were probably quite aware of his writing.
Yeah.
And this is the 500th anniversary
of
More's Utopia, so it's worth talking about. But you know, people have been arguing about what More meant ever since he wrote it, and it's ironic because it's a slim and very, you know, sort of plain spoken book. Whether More was using this fictional island nation of Utopia as an actual proposal for how we might, you know, amend, you know, we meaning his peers in the 1500s, how British society might be amended. Or was it a farce, or was it just a sort of way of critiquing the present? And I think probably it's a little of all of the above. Mm-hmm. And it's almost laughable how partisans of every stripe have claimed More for their own. And of course, he ended up being a very radical opponent of the Reformation and died for it. And that's why he's now Saint Thomas More to some. But I think that Moore's basically what Moore did and his great contribution to the subject was sort of not necessarily lay down the most exciting set of utopian ideas, but to establish the form, which has been imitated endlessly, of a utopian narrative, a way of expressing political and social ideas through this pretty stock formula of, you know, it's usually some character washes up on a beach or lands on a new planet or discovers some unknown society in the jungle. And then they sort of walk around for a few weeks. Often they fall in love with a member of this society.
Yeah.
And as they go, they kind of learn the ropes. And as literature, it's in my view, tends to be quite boring because, you know, it's usually you say, oh, hello, Fred, tell me about your sewage system. And then Fred talks for 40 minutes about sewage. It's a sort of armature on which to hang you know, the author's ideas about what the ideal society would look like. But in terms of how it played out in the United States in the 19th century, Etienne Cabet, who was sort of one of the leading and ultimately the leading communist in France briefly, reads Moore in the British Library while he's exiled from France in the British Museum in London and basically writes his own version, which he calls Travels in Icaria, follows Moore's formula, though unfortunately it's about 50 times longer than Moore's rather.
Did you read it, by the way? Did you have to put yourself through that?
I didn't read all of it, and I'm sure a few people have, but it's been a while. He kept adding appendices to it, but I slogged my way through most of it, and I read it in translation, I should say, but you know it. It's interesting as a historical document, and it's sort of hard to get my mind around how incredibly popular it was for sort of working people in France in the 1840s. This book was a bestseller.
Yeah.
And basically the book describes a fictional society called Icaria.
Right.
And how wonderful it is. And it's sort of this workers' paradise where everything's totally equal and everything's fully nationalized. And in the sort of long run out after the restoration of the French monarchy, after the revolution, after the empire has been declared, working class French people, and not usually it tended to not be the poorest people. It wasn't farmers or sort of day laborers. It was artisans who really picked up this idea, and they got so into it that they started forming little Icarian reading groups, and they had newspapers and Icarian songs, and eventually they said, let's just go found this society. And they came to Texas and had a terrible time of it in the Trinity River Valley, and left Texas because the land was just totally unusable. It was a real estate deal brokered by Robert Owen, the guy who started the community in Indiana, and it was just a terrible deal. They had bought a bunch of desert scrub land and were unable to really homestead it, not to mention the fact that they were tailors and shoemakers and had never been, you know, outside of their small French cities. So they leave Texas after quite a few of them die of, you know, rattlesnakes and dysentery and lightning and starvation and everything else that can happen on the frontier.
It was a disaster. Yeah.
It was an unmitigated disaster. A lot of them went back to France because this is 1848, right when the revolution breaks out in France. And so they think, well, we came all this way to invent a new society, but one's starting in France. So some of them, very angry with their fearless leader, Etienne Cabet, sail back to France. The rest stay loyal to him, and they go to Illinois, where they buy from the departing Mormons the center section of the city of Nauvoo, which at a point in time had been sort of rivaled Chicago as the largest settlement in Illinois. So the Mormons were looking for a buyer, and it was a sort of ready-made sort of city with all these facilities that would be useful for a communalist type of organization, large halls and dining halls and things.
I loved this part of the book. And you talk about it. So by 1855, there's like 500 people, I think, living in Nauvoo here. Most of them are French, others from Europe as well. You say it was pretty intense. I mean, it's interesting. They tried to renovate the Nauvoo Temple the Mormons had abandoned, but a sort of a tornado finishes the building off, and they kind of give it up. But I guess they use the limestone to make other buildings. But they eat together. They farm together. They try to plant a vineyard. Lots of hard work. It was a pretty interesting experiment.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about all of these communities is that they were incredibly hardworking.
Yeah.
I think since their ideas are sort of outlandish often, there's a tendency to imagine them as dilettantes. But when you read the details of their frontier lives, it's incredibly impressive. In Nauvoo, which they called Nauvoo Icaria.
Yeah.
They sort of combined the two names. They wore matching clothes. They ate all their meals together. And they lived very, very well. I mean, for hard frontier living, they slowly learned how to farm. And they also, in all of these communities, they sort of became this bastion of what we might call high culture in the frontier. So they're surrounded by, you know, nothing but small homesteads, and they have an orchestra, and they're putting on operas every week, and their American neighbors are coming to watch their plays, which are usually in French. But you know, they have the biggest library in the state of Illinois. They're really focused on creating the society in this novel that their leader had written, and so a big aspect of that society was, as he describes it, is entertainment, you know, sort of like bourgeois pleasures becoming suddenly available to the working class. So in Icaria, they do a pretty good job of recreating that until they begin fighting amongst themselves.
Yeah.
And then the community splits. The leader takes off and promptly dies. With a small contingent, they end up in
Missouri. How he dies, though. I think that's really interesting. He has this fit of anger after a maid brings him the wrong breakfast.
Yeah, well, that's the report that I could find the most. He definitely dies of a stroke or apoplexy, I think is how they're describing it then. But it's funny because he by that point had become this very divisive figure. Half the community revere him, and it's an almost messianic relationship. They call him Papa.
Yeah.
And he's not like a cult leader, I would say, but he's quite authoritarian.
He seemed like a cult leader, I have to say, though. I mean, he bans drinking and smoking and hunting and fishing for sport. He's super paranoid. He gets spies to look at everybody else. I mean, it seems like he kind of seemed like a cult leader in the end to me.
He definitely becomes a nightmare.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's not a cult leader insofar as they sort of like vote him out of the society. He
right.
has to leave. The democracy still exists, but
yeah.
he does kind of descend into paranoia because, and I think this is a problem that dogs all utopian communities, the rhetoric of where they were supposed to be was so high flown. You know, they should be in this communist paradise that they've all been dreaming about for decades at that point already, and they're not. And he starts getting anxious that not enough work is being performed, and he has to actually leave to go back to France to face some criminal charges. And while he's gone, I guess the workshops kind of slowed down. The men started drinking a lot and spending all their time fishing on the Mississippi. And so when he returns, he kind of instigates this belt tightening that is not met very enthusiastically, and the community splits. But the community that stays behind, and they ultimately leave Nauvoo for a very, very rural part of Iowa where there's basically nothing at the time, they do quite well and hang on until after the Civil War into the 1870s, and some of them end up setting up a small community near where I'm sitting right now in Northern California.
Mm, yeah. It's interesting that we don't have a lot of time to talk about John Humphrey Noyes and the Perfectionists, the Oneida community in New York. It's really fascinating. One of the things that's interesting is, of course, all this experimentation they do in terms of free sex, differing views of marriage in all of these groups. You know, the Shakers sort of read something into it. Noyes reads something in the Bible that this is an invitation to free sex. People should read the book to get a sense of the bigger story. But in the end, is it instructive to say that they all have this unanimous vote in the end that says, let's stop this free sex thing. It's not working.
Well, free sex is a kind of misleading term, even though the Oneida community starts out using the term free love. In fact, they claim to have coined the term free love. They ultimately their system was actually quite controlled and organized. The term they land on is complex marriage, which basically means that every male in the community is married to every female. So theoretically, any male and any female can couple up within the sort of norms and rules of their society. But of course, it didn't really play out that way, and all the complicated power dynamics in the community were expressed sort of in the bedroom, like who was allowed to sleep with whom ended up being quite complicated. But I think as you started to suggest at the beginning of your question, and I think is so fascinating, is that basically the Oneida community, who were having lots of sex, and the Shakers, who were having no sex, were basically not only reading the same little part of the Bible for justification, but like literally the same sentences. But they also were basically trying to do the same thing. They thought that the monogamous traditional family was a negative force in society. And so to change that, you have to change sexual relations. You can't give up, you know, monogamy and marriage without changing how people have sex with each other. So while the Shakers were having none and the perfectionists, as they called themselves, were having lots, they were all basically trying to accomplish the same end, which is living as if the millennium has already begun, living as if we are already in the kingdom of God. And they recognize that amazingly. You wouldn't think that people who had no sex could look over at people who are having lots of sex and say, like, oh, you know, they're just trying to get to the same place by a different route. But they did recognize each other as collaborators. Not collaborators. They call themselves noble contestants, you know, in trying to bring heaven to earth.
Let me ask you finally. You write in the book that these days, in the 21st century, our impulse is to look back rather than look forward for something ideal. We've made our history into a sort of utopia, is how you put it. You know, you say that when we can be bothered to speculate about the future, often our assessments are pretty grim. So let me ask you finally, what happens to a society that doesn't have fantasies about the shape of things to come?
I don't know, but I think that what happens is that whatever change happens, and obviously societies always change, it happens sort of not randomly, but not guided by any sort of moral impulse. You know, we find ourselves with the new technology, and suddenly we're all using it, and the world shapes itself around that. Technological innovation becomes this sort of force that leads us into the future, which is fine if you're picking the course. If you say, we want to have technologies that do X, Y, and Z for us, as opposed to the process being sort of accidental and random and overly influenced by markets.
Chris Jennings, his book is Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism, joined us from KQED in San Francisco. Chris, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Buck Fabrizio.